Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to Lee and the IC. My name is Alex Newman, an associate editor at the Investors Chronicle, and I'm delighted to be here in the FD studios again with Lord Lee of Trafford. As a quick reminder, the format of these podcasts is slightly different to other episodes in this channel. So if you're investing or considering investing in shares, it's certainly for you, especially if those shares are UK listed. But befitting the topic of personal finance, the tone and content is a bit more personal than you might be used to from our regular interviews with fund managers and commentators. That's because everything we talk about is filtered through the thoughts, actions, and feelings of one of the most seasoned personal investors in the country. As I've said before, this makes it a sort of extended conversation with Lord John Lee, drawing on his decades of practical and personal experience as an investor. At this point, I should throw in the disclaimer that though we will be talking about individual stocks and John's portfolio in detail, this podcast is purely for educational purposes and nothing in it should be taken as financial advice or recommendations to buy or sell shares. This month, we're going to be talking about another of John's holdings, his approach to different assets, property, and the latest goings on in his portfolio. We'll also be responding to a few of the fantastic questions you've sent in for John, which, as a reminder, you can do by emailing me at alex.newman@ft.com. Anyway, let's get to it. John, a very warm welcome to you on a quite cold Friday. How are you doing?
Fine, in good shape, thank you. But please, it's Friday.
Yeah.
It's been a tough week.
Yes, a long week. Let's begin with the stock I wanted to talk with you about today. That's Lok'nStore. I expect lots of listeners will be familiar with the company or might vaguely recognise the brand or name. But for those who don't know or aren't familiar, could you please introduce the company and what it does, and also how you came to be involved as an investor?
Well, Lok'nStore is one of the self-storage or safe storage companies. The better known ones are probably Big Yellow and SafeStore. But Lok'nStore is a significant player, probably number four or five in the overall table of size of those companies. And I first invested in 2013, 10 years ago. Actually, I noticed that Town Centre Securities, a property company that I was then invested in and know well, had started to build up a stake in Lok'nStore, and I followed them. The broad attraction to that sector was that we were, as compared with America, really very, very thinly endowed with self-storage and safe storage as an operation as compared with America. And of course, we're still well behind. You know, there is a far greater usage of those facilities in the States. But I liked Lok'nStore. It looked a good, solid, growing company. And I particularly like the fact that the chief executive and founder, Andrew Jacobs, had a big stake in it, which is something that I've always regarded as important skin in the game. And so I bought in 2013 my first holding at, I think, about 137. Looking back, as is my normal practice, if I like a company, I will build up a more significant holding. And I think I've bought over the years on about 17 separate occasions, up to about £5.80, I think, on one occasion. But that would be the peak buy. And I think I did make one small sale at some stage. But essentially, it's a holding that I've had for 10 years, and it's now a significant holding.
So you explained a bit of your rationale for investing. I mean, in some ways, it sounds fairly simple. People need places to store their small business wares or home contents in. Demand for that is strong in a country where perhaps space is at a little bit of a premium. Has the investment case evolved a lot in that decade?
I don't think there's been any great change in the fundamentals, but I think it would be fair to say that the sector isn't quite as buoyant as it has been. One of the interesting features to me was the discovery that a significant number of people used those safe storage operations to store their business assets if they were operating eBay type businesses. So it's not just residential, as you pointed out, Alex. They have commercial application as well. So it's certainly a holding that's performed well for me over the years, although the shares have come back somewhat from the absolute peak.
Yeah, we can come on to valuation and how the shares have been trading in a moment. I mean, slightly unusually for this sector, while operating as in the real estate game, it's not structured as a real estate investment trust, which means there, you know, it's a bit, there's a bit more flexibility when it comes to holding back cash for dividends, and it changes their tax status a little bit because they're a trading company. Do you judge this to have been a smart call on behalf of management? I mean, some of the peers you mentioned are structured as REITs.
I don't think it needed to be a REIT, but I think, as you rightly say, it although it's on AIM, it is classed as a, and property is the base of it, it is classed as a trading company. And although, you know, there's no official list or official recognition by the, you know, the revenues to what is an approved AIM company for you know, for inheritance tax purposes, I think it is judged and assumed that a lock and store does qualify. And in terms of dividends, of course, one of the attractions is that they are very much focused on paying out dividends. And I think we've had 12 years of successive dividend growth, around about 10% per annum increase. So the dividend income from that has been quite significant. My only regret is that initially it didn't go into my ISA. It went into my non-ISA. So I don't get the full tax coverage and benefit of that, but I do have some shareholding in Lock and Store in my eyes.
Okay, and therefore it's kind of tax wrapped. So, I mean, the latest dividend increase was, we had the full year results for the year to July about 3 weeks ago now. I mean, on the face of it, you know, as well as the dividend hike, there were lots of positives there. It was able to pass on price rises, it increased its recurring revenue and adjusted profits, cut its absolute debt, which is always a nice thing to see when interest rates are so much higher, and lowered its group-wide leverage. And you know, on top of that, it's grown its adjusted net asset value to close to £10. The shares, however, are trading a bit more like £7.60, 23% discount or so. Why do you think the market has been so pessimistic, or is so pessimistic?
Well, I think that it's been a difficult time for property companies, or anything, any company related to property activities, and you know, all the property companies came down. But of course, I think with the view now that interest rates have peaked, and probably we can look ahead to next year to some modest reduction, all being well, there has been a bit of a pickup generally in property shares. So you know, I'm taking quite an optimistic view. Then I think there was a little bit of a negative probably because Andrew Jacobs, who has built it up and has still got a big stake in it, did sell some shares, which is always a, you know, a tad negative. Although I think those shares that he sold were snapped up by some existing institutions and some new institutions as well, which is a plus.
But he did use your bugbear excuse of providing liquidity.
Well, that's right.
He gets a pass this time.
Yeah, well, he does because of retaining a fair stake, and because having talked to him, you know, I do take a positive view overall. But nevertheless, I never like to see, you know, any director selling any significant shareholdings. It has to be a mild negative. But the other interesting thing that Lock and Store have been doing, apart from geographically pushing up the country, because originally it was very much southern orientated, and now they're moving up, and they've got a number of operations in the north, I think in Warrington and Bolton, and I think they're going on to the Wirral as well. So they're sort of gradually pushing up country and expanding. That although the majority of their stores are freehold, hence the asset value, they're now operating an increasing number, I think 16 or so, potentially 16, managing them, as it were, for other owners of the properties. And this means, of course, that it's relatively asset light, right, as compared with having to invest a great chunk of money in owning the freehold. And so overall, the portfolio is expanding quite steadily. Mm. But the as you rightly said a little bit earlier in your opening summary, Alex, the debt really is quite low, compared with a lot of property companies. So it's travelling quite nicely as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to that point on assets and I suppose the weight of capital in a business in a moment. Just to stay with Mr. Jacobs, if I may, for one more minute. I mean, this isn't an enormous company in some levels. It's £250 million or so market capitalization. been on AIM, as we said, since 2000. And Mr. Jacobs was the founder, remains as the chairman. You know, huge longevity in his service and staying with the business. I mean, he's not said anything on his retirement plans. I don't want to sort of speculate here about, you know, without putting questions to him directly. But we have talked a bit about management in the last couple of shows. We had an interesting question from one listener who asked if your habit is to follow long-serving CEOs out of the business if you're unsure of the succession plan. Maybe parking lock and store to the side here, but just conscious of, you know, of the key person risk that perhaps exists in this business. What would your attitude be towards the impending departure of someone you've known as part of the business for a long time?
Well, I think it would depend. Mm. On what the business, what sort of business it was in, and whether the individual being promoted to CEO was someone who'd been a key executive for a number of years within that business, or, you know, someone from outside with a reputation. I think it's very difficult to say how one would necessarily react. You know, one accepts obviously that chief executives do move on after a period, and there is always change taking place with professional managers.
Yeah.
But of course, I think I've probably prospered over the years by investing in companies where there were either family-controlled businesses, with families having a big stake, or an individual who's built up that business and is seeking to capitalise. Mm. So my guess would be, and I've always thought, that at some stage, probably Lock and Store would be absorbed by a larger player, perhaps from the United States, we don't know, because one or two of the US companies have been pushing in, and it would, a company of the Lock and Store size would make an ideal acquisition for a thrusting and expanding American group.
Yeah.
There's something to be said for having a company that maybe is sort of 3, 4, 5, third, fourth, fifth in the overall capitalization in that sector, if you
for
follow
sure.
me.
Yeah, absolutely. If a company were to, you know, run the rule over the business, they would notice, obviously, as we mentioned, that they are trading quite a bit below book value or NAV. I mean, is that the primary reference point for valuing a company like this, a property? I mean, it's doing property management now as well, but it's also a big property owner. Should we be looking at NAV as the point at which a company is undervalued?
Well, it's a big piece on the jigsaw, put it that way. And certainly in the case of property companies or property-based companies like Lock and Store, it is key. But it's not the sole piece of the jigsaw that you look at, obviously. If anything, you know, the debt ratio is probably that much more important. Mm-hmm. But overall, what I like about Lock and Store is that it has expanded very significantly over the years, but in a conservative way. And Andrew Jacobs, I think, has handled the financial side of it, because he does have a city background, the financial side of it very well, in terms of broadly borrowing at the right time, selling one or two attractive assets and moving more into the management of stores. So really handling it in quite a clever way. So, you know, there's considerable entrepreneurial talent there, and one recognises that. And you know, he's done very well for himself with his shareholding, and shareholders who got in earlier than me have done extremely well.
Yeah. I mean, that brings us on fairly neatly to something else I wanted to talk about, which was assets. I mean, in the case of Lock and Store, we obviously have, you know, this strong weighting to hard assets in its real estate portfolio. But also, as you mentioned, you know, it's part of the value in Lock and Store now is not only its brand and the goodwill it's built up there, but as you say, the management services, which is not going to be valued at the same level on the balance sheet, but which is obviously something that people are willing to pay for to manage properties on their behalf. That broadly, under the intangible umbrella of assets, is something that's a lot harder to value, isn't it, for investors? What's your
Correct.
You know, what's your sort of general approach to, I know it's a very open-ended question, but do you like to see, you know, a greater balance to hard assets, or you think long and hard about how intangibles might be the key thing to invest
yes,
in?
Yes, I think, well, basically I'm a fairly conservative investor,
right.
Not in the business of taking great risks. So therefore I try to cover the downside. Mm. And therefore, you know, I tend to steer well away from companies with excessive debts. I don't always get that right, but one tries to do that. But it's just a factor that one does take into account. But it's, yes, it's very nice to see hard assets there, as it were. But essentially, a business that has been built up conservatively, you know, the dividend over the years when one works, I've not worked it out mathematically, but for the 10 years I've been invested in it, we've had something like a 10% increase each year. Mm. So, you know, there is now quite an attractive dividend yield, positive yield. There wasn't initially, but there is a hard asset base to actually protect that investment and give one peace of mind.
Yeah. Another of your property holdings is the flexible office space firm Workspace. I mean, that's another interesting example, isn't it? Because, you know, they're on one level, they seem to be a straight up landlord, but they're operating in a kind of hybrid services business there, in that their leases are very flexible and they, you know, they're catering to lots of different customer groups. What does the equation boil down to there? Why are you interested in this business?
Well, I was invested in it years ago when, I think I'm right in saying, it was called London Industrial.
Okay.
And it was put together by two or three people who worked, I think for the GLC, and I think they as it were, bought out the sort of mixed property holdings of the GLC, and that was the foundation of London Industrial. And of course, over the years, it has grown, name changed to Workspace, and now they have something like 70 different sites in and around the southeast, predominantly, and recently made a takeover bid for Mackay, that went through, and I think they've sold some of the Mackay properties off. But essentially, they've got, I think, around 70 different sites, mixed sites of light industrial and an office as well. Very flexible, very entrepreneurial, and the team is very experienced. And here again, and this attracted me more recently, probably a year or so ago, the shares were standing and are standing still at a very significant discount to assets. That obviously appeals. And also, there is an investment group who I think have 28 or 29% of it just before takeover is actually triggered, which one would regard as a very strategic stake. So at some stage, and it could happen next week or it could happen in 5 years' time, I'm sure in some way that asset value will be reflected in the price, and there will be corporate activity.
Right.
But in the meantime, there's a very nice sort of near 5% dividend yield and fairly optimistic trading announcements. So, you know, I'm pretty happy with it. Tuck it away. Value will come through in the end, I'm sure.
Yeah. Property has been the most, I would argue, probably the most popular route in the UK towards wealth creation over the last few decades. You know, many individual landlords probably have found that, you know, that actually the work involved is a little bit closer to, you know, what Workspace management is having to do now, that you actually you have to be a lot more hands-on with tenants than you sometimes expect, and the yield on or the net initial yield sort of sometimes gets a bit diluted when you have to factor in all the things you must do to manage property. You're obviously a big champion of ICEs and stocks. I mean, obviously you invest a little bit in property through these companies. What's been your attitude to property investing, either, you know, the buy-to-let angle or more broadly in terms of physical?
Well, I've never really gone in for buy-to-let myself. Right. I mean, I've always fortunately been able to buy my own home. I think the first house I bought myself was in about 1968, I think for about £8,000.
Okay.
The more recent one, 8 years ago in Richmond, where we now live, Richmond, Surrey, was somewhat more than that £8,000, right. I have to say. So over the years, my generation obviously have been very fortunate to be home-owning and property-owning. And, of course, many of those property companies over the years also prospered. But I remember when I first started investing, there were any number of small quoted property companies, quoted residential companies and quoted commercial companies as well, often built up by a family or an individual, and almost all those have disappeared.
Right.
With the possible exception of something like Town Centre, controlled by the Ziff family from Leeds, which, you know, has done very well over the years, and I've been a shelled in and out of that. But the rental market obviously has been much more tricky with the changes that George Osborne unfortunately brought in, I think I'm right in saying, disallowing interest on borrowings. Mm. And combination of that and, you know, some of the environmental restrictions now have caused many landlords to pull out of the market. That sector has been declining. And so rents have been pushing up. And of course, it's once conscious that it's very difficult for young people now to, you know, to find a property to rent. Mm-hmm. Anything that looks at all attractive, you know, you've got a queue of 15 or 20 people there, as it were. As I say, we've seen rent going up. You've also seen, by the way, one or two larger commercial companies getting involved in the rental sector. Grainger probably is the mm-hmm. best example of that. I mean, Grainger used to be almost entirely focused on owning smaller residential properties, and now they've moved in a fairly significant way into the construction of new developments down south for rent.
Mm.
And I think one or two of the insurance companies have done that as well. But I've never really been a property investor. I've enjoyed investing in the stock market much more, as it were, and found that much more interesting. So that's where my pennies have gone.
Sure. I suppose one thing that is hard for some people to get past is the psychological attachment to bricks and mortar. I can see this asset. A house is obviously a good example of that. Some people end up with property because that is the, you know, via inheritance or otherwise, that is the main store of wealth that a lot of people have in their lives, and they become accidental landlords. What would you say to, I suppose, people for whom it is a bit of a psychological obstacle to think, well, I wouldn't want to put my money in stocks and shares? It's you know, you see prices going up and down every day. I like the tangible feel of a property that, you know, might be able to be rented out or has a use value. What's the break you've been able to make with that?
I can entirely accept that, you know, some people like to own and see the property, but of course the debit is, you don't have anything like the flexibility,
right,
with property that you do with stocks and shares, particularly if you invest in some of the large cap stocks, you know, like the Shells or the insurance companies, or in my case, you know, the M&G, for example, where if for whatever reason, you know, I wanted to get money out, either for personal needs or to reinvest somewhere, I guess one spot's a better opportunity, you know, I can sell that holding immediately.
Mm.
You can't do it so easily with some of the small caps holdings. That's why in my ISA portfolio now, I try to have a balance between, you know, some of the larger cap stocks with big dividend yields and some of the smaller cap stocks that I've got long-term faith in for capital growth and maybe more yeah. modest dividends. So I like the flexibility of stocks and shares, and also, as I think I made clear or indicated in the past, been on the receiving end of, you know, something like 60 takeovers and take privates, which have created liquidity and delivered a premium on then prevailing prices, which is not, of course, something you get with property.
Yeah.
For me, I think it comes down to a combination of interest and also financial flexibility, and that's why I come down on the side of the stocks yeah. and shares.
So flexibility in your asset choice. When it comes to property, flexibility in the model, you know, workspace and lock and store, both, you know, flexible space,
right,
creators. Would you buy traditional office companies right now? I mean, there's some pretty cheap offers on there.
The answer is yes. Would I? But would they are there? Would I be buying them? I don't think I would.
Right.
You know, I still think there is the COVID legacy of people yeah. working at home from home. Although some companies are beginning to insist on people coming back to the office so many days a week, I think working from home is, you know, with modern technology, modern age, is clearly going to be with us for a long, long time. So, you know, I'm not sure that I would want to be investing in offices. And also, of course, people who are looking for, or firms who are looking for office accommodation, do want all the time, you know, a better quality office, to meet higher environmental standards.
Mm.
And therefore, you know, you can't just sit on an office block for 50 years, as it were. You have to spend money on reconditioning and improving, as it were, and modernizing. So, you know, it can be quite expensive ownership structure.
So as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we've had some very smart questions from listeners in recent weeks. One of them I wanted to raise just before we conclude was from Helen. She actually sent a number of very good questions in, but one of them jumped out to me. By way of background, Helen and her husband are both investors, and she's keen to avoid duplication across their portfolios. I assume discussing similar themes and potential investments. She wanted to know how or if you go about rebalancing your portfolio, John, in terms of, I suppose, size, number and type of holdings. Do you have a particular thought process here, or does it sort of evolve?
I don't think it's a thought process. I think it's more a question of a feel, right, in a way. One comes back to one's basics, really. I'm very much a long-term investor. If I like a company, particularly with some of the smaller caps that I focus on, like Lok & Store, you know, I will buy on many occasions and build up that holding. So I think I said that I bought about 17 times with Lok & Store. I think with Treat, which is my second largest holding, I think. But as between occasions over the years, getting the balance right between small caps and some of the larger cap stocks. Over the last 2 or 3 years, I have put a fair amount into some of those big cap stocks, high yielding, very solid businesses like M&G and Aviva and Legal & General and Phoenix, you know, where you're getting a dividend yield of somewhere between 8 and 10%, hugely attractive within an ISA, tax-free, very attractive a wrapper. And so overall, one can generate the income through those stocks, and thus one can afford to hold some of the smaller caps that are possibly not distributing the rate of dividend that you would ideally like. What it also means, if you don't need to take the dividend actually out in cash terms, and you want to reinvest it, you can reinvest some of the substantial dividends in some of the smaller caps. So very recently, for example, I received a very nice interim dividend from M&G.
I was going to ask, the big event since we last spoke.
And, you know, I was able to decide to keep that money within the ISA portfolio, not take it out. And I think I topped up four of my smaller ISA holdings. From memory, I think Vianet, VP is a more recent holding, Plant Hire, Yorkshire Plant Hire Company, Secure Trust, the small banking business, huge discount to assets there and a big yield, and Concurrent Technologies, which has been one of my favourite stocks, which is now, I think, moving to take off. Right. I see a significant jump in bottom line profits coming there on the strength of, you know, big growth in their exports to America on the defence front.
Yeah, certainly names we can unpack in greater depth in future episodes. I did notice that none of those stocks were investment trusts, and I suppose having just put out our investment trust special, it would be remiss of me not to ask about your thoughts on investment trusts. I mean, the yields might not be at 8 to 10% on most investment trusts, but some of the discounts are, you know, I think the average is something like 17% now. Do you use investment trusts at all, John, or do you see them as a benefit?
No, I don't. I remember years ago, my father used to, when he was investing, you know, 40, 50 years ago, he used to be an investment trust man, and he actually did put £1,000 for each of my daughters, I think nearly 40 years ago, into investment Save and Prosper investment trust units. Mm. And I think that £1,000 has grown over the years with the dividends reinvested, you know, to upper 30,000s now. Right. Significant growth. So for someone who is a long-term investor and doesn't want to take their own decisions, by and large, generalization, much better to invest in investment trusts where there is some gearing benefit as well, rather than, you know, a more flat unit trust fund or open-ended fund. And over the years, some of those investment trusts have performed very well indeed. At the moment, yes, quite nice discounts, but the discounts aren't quite as great as one or two of the property companies that we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. What the final weeks of 2023 looking like for you? Have you got as much in your portfolio and beyond that you're looking forward to?
Well, I think that what is pleasing to me is that the market, I feel the market is looking to go forward to go upwards.
Right.
Obviously, the disastrous situation of the Middle East, the war in Ukraine, so a lot of negatives. On the other hand, positives are, I think we've probably peaked with interest rates. Inflation is coming down a little faster than people imagine. And I think there's a little bit more of a positive economic feeling around the place. And the stock market, I think, is extremely cheap. Mm. And you only need to look at some of the takeover bids that have come through in the last, you know, couple of weeks, as it were, the premiums on prevailing prices. Even if you regard the more recent takeover of Hotel Chocolat by Mars as where the premium on the then prevailing price was about 170% as a somewhat special. Nevertheless, I look at my own portfolio and certainly as far as the smaller cap stocks are concerned, you know, I think the vast majority are worth, you know, double the current market price. Right. So, you know, to me, it's you know, buy now, fill your boots.
Yeah. Well, let's see how those boots are looking next time when we speak. Lots to unpack then, which of course can include any questions you'd like to put to John, which again, that email you can do by getting in touch at alex.newman@ft.com. Until then, all that's left for me to say is to thank you for listening. Thank you, John, for your thoughts.
My pleasure.
And to thank our producer, Maddie Apthorpe, for all her work behind the soundboard. Until next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.